Council may come forward. This case is number 07-1539, Predicate Logic against Distributive Software. The appellant has chosen not to argue and to rely on his briefs, but two of you wish to be heard?
Yes, briefly.
Okay, please proceed, Mr. Wynn.
Mr. Wynn. Good morning, may it please the court. I'm John Wynn, and this is Bernard Kleinke from Ducor Spradling Metzger & Wynn on behalf of the appellee, Distributive Software. I will be speaking for the first 10 minutes or so. If any questions are raised that I need Mr. Kleinke's assistance on, he'll be reserving 2 or 3 minutes for him at that point. Essentially, without going back through what we've said in the brief, we wanted to raise 2 or 3 points to the court in terms of this case. We believe that the district court got this right. It got it right by focusing on the word said and the placement of the word said.
Mr. Wynn, I'd like to get into the broader question of the statute here.
Sure.
The court was citing, this is a reexamination case, right?
That's correct.
The court was citing reissue law and talking about whether there was a substantive change in the claims.
Correct.
But and then invalidate found there was and invalidated the claims.
Because it was broadening.
Yeah, but, well, okay, because of the broadening. But he was working on citing reissue law, whereas both reexamination statutes permit amendment substantive change, as long as they're narrowed, right?
That's not, well, my reading of the cases, and I...
But how about reading the statutes?
Well, 307B, I believe, references to 252, and I believe that this court has interpreted them in the same fashion. I don't believe that that distinction is there, number one. Number two, since a broadening...
314, which follows 307, conducts inter-parties examination, re-exam... Patent owners shall be permitted to propose any amendment except that no enlarging of the scope. So was he in the right law? Or is it your position that maybe not, but that's moot, because as long as there was any enlargement, then he was right?
I guess our position would be that because it was narrowed and broadened, the courts have looked at that in the past and said that's tantamount to a broadening amendment in this case. And the case law on reexamination, I believe, Seattle Box, Quantum, and Thermaloy.
But the examiner is bound to see that the claims are not broadened. And it's
correct.
Reasonably apparent here that the way the examiner was looking at the claims was that they were in accordance with the statute. Isn't it appropriate, therefore, to construe the claims in the manner in which the office necessarily construed them in light of the statute?
I think that it is. Again, I think that the examiners made similar mistakes in the Seattle Box case, the Quantum case, and the Thermaloy case that we cite. I think that there is a practice that they're going to try and comply with, but particularly in light of the lengthy and back and forth pattern of reexamination in this case that involved.
Well, why doesn't it depend on whether or not the claims necessarily must be read as broadened, or whether in fact they can continue to be read in accordance with the statute?
But I don't believe
the examiner apparently did.
The examiner apparently thought that, but I don't believe that the claims can be read in that fashion, because I believe that the word said, as it was placed in the generating and storing step of the original claims language, has to have a meaning. That's another axiom of the interpretation that the examiner should be looking at, that each word in the patent.
But if you have two limitations, and one is narrowed and one is broadened, the limitation, second one, may be broadened, but isn't the claim narrower because one of the other limitations is narrowed?
No, I believe that overall this is a broadened claim because you can now bring in a number of other accused software programs that would...
Where the narrowing doesn't matter?
Where the narrowing doesn't matter because you've generated more than one index, and by virtue of generating more than one index and only instantiating a subset of those indexes, you're now the patent now reads on your device or your software.
Now where is it provided that if... Because the statute says you can't expand the claims. Where does the consequence of that violation appear? Where does it say, and the patent shall henceforth be invalid?
Yeah, in both, I think, the Rodim case and Seattle Box. That's exactly what happened, and I think that's exactly what the consequence was. This court found both the patent to be invalid in each case because of that change.
It's not unreasonable. It's really the placement of at least one said or said at least one. I mean, that's...
Correct.
Couldn't that have been read by the examiner as a distinction without a difference?
Well, I think that if the examiner was looking at the language in front of him, from the internal construction of the original claims, there were a couple of places where the examiner should see that there is a meaning to that distinction. For instance, in the comparing step, which was the fourth or fifth step in the original patent claims, when the author wished to say, you take a subset of all of the generated indexes and you prepare or you perform a function on them, the language used, rather than said at least one index, was that you would compare at least one of the data sets linked to at least one of said instantiated indexes. That's the way that this original patent, the original claims, dealt with it when they wanted to say a subset. And they and that was not the language that was used in the instantiating or the second storage step.
It seems to me that there was perhaps some confusion as to how the claim should be read, because that last provision, the comparing step, talks about comparing at least one of the data sets, etc., to at least one of the instantiated index to at least another.
That's correct.
But earlier in the claim, it just talks about at least one. So the question is, well, what exactly does that mean?
That's correct. And
but
I think
certainly implicit, in light of the language of the comparing step, there had to have been at least two. Otherwise, you'd have nothing to compare.
Well, that, I think, is correct. I think that's a 112 issue that may come up later if the case proceeds, but I think the argument that would be made by appellant...
It strikes me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it strikes me that the changes that were made at the very end of this prosecution were made to fix these seemingly 112 kind of problems. To me, that's emphasized by the fact that the language the examiner pointed to as the basis for his allowing the claims is language that was in there right from the outset. It was the comparing step itself.
He said the comparing was not in Ware, Otake, and the Sprague references. He also said other things, such as the Ware and Otake and Sprague references, didn't deal with at least one or one or more.
Yeah, but if that was implicit in the claim to start with, then it doesn't make any difference. I want to just get to the question of whether this is a broadening claim or not.
Okay, may I make one comment that I think
yes,
deals
please.
With both of those?
Please.
I think that even if you read the initial claim limitations as requiring two indexes based on the comparing step, the way that the initial claim one and all of the dependent claims read was that you could create more than two indexes. It went 2, 3, 4, you could create 50 indexes if you wanted. So the effect of it, even if you start with a requirement of two indexes rather than one, the effect of this change of coming back down and saying you need to instantiate and second store only one index, the effect of it is still broadening because you no longer have to do these things to all of the indexes.
But why do you have to do it to all of the indexes? And that's the exact question I was about to ask. That seems to be what the district court did in the hypothetical where there were four indexes. The court says, let's look at how the original version of Claim 1 operates when at least one is read to be in actuality four.
Right.
But why would one have to read it as four?
One could read it as three. One could read it as 50. All that the court
is at least one, which means it could be one, two, three, four.
But what the court is saying is that in terms of the reach of the limitations in the original patent, in terms of the reach, it has reach which goes beyond one, and that's what he was trying to talk about. And in the
original, but it requires. In the change, the first instantiation and the second instantiation.
Correct.
That wasn't in the original claim. Isn't that a narrowing when you add limitations?
Yes, that is. The broadening change is that you don't have to do it to all of the indexes generated. And the narrowing claim is exactly as the court has just stated. Coming back to this, there are three or four reasons that that the original language can and should be interpreted to require instantiation and second storage of all of the indexes that are generated. One is the meaning of the word said, and said as placed in this location, said at least one index is referring back to the generating step where it talks about at least one index being generated.
Let's look at the language. The claim one starts out generating by means of the program computer, at least one hierarchical index linked to each of the input data components, generating at least one.
Right.
So it could generate two, three, four, doesn't matter. The claim would read on a system that generated one, two, three, four. Any of
correct.
The above. The claim is not limited to...
To one.
To one.
Right.
So a system that, for example, generated two, that claim would read on that.
That's correct.
And it just is generating at least one. So in our hypothetical, there would be two. Then it would go on storing said at least one index.
Yeah, said at least one. Said at least one would refer to two in that instance. And this is also an interpretation that was taken by predicate in the at the trial.
Why does set at least one mean four?
Set at least one is referring to the group that you generate in the generating step.
It says generating at least one. So in the hypothetical where there are two, the claim calls for generating at least one, and then it goes on to say storing that one. Instantiating that one.
Look at the compare step for a second, if you would, where the draftsperson with the original language was attempting to convey exactly the concept that the court's discussing right now. A concept where you have a universe and a subset. And what you're trying to call out to the attention of anybody who's trying to understand what this teaches is that you're only dealing with the subset. That's exactly what he was trying to do in the original language in the compare step. And what he said in the first line of the compare step was you compare at least one of the data sets, what data set? Linked to at least one of said instantiated indexes. That's the way that draftsman understood you would state this. That's the way he would get across what he was trying to say when he's talking about a subset of the universe.
Yeah, so this claim would not read on a system where there wasn't at least two.
I think that's a credible argument on that, but what my point is that in terms of the language that would have been used to convey what the court is attempting to convey about the instantiation step would match that language. There's also something that I wanted to just point out briefly.
I'm having trouble why this claim would not read on a system where there are four.
You're talking about the original claim.
The original claim.
It would, as long as all four were instantiated and second stored. And then...
But that's the narrowing part. I'm looking for where it's broadened. Was in the original claim.
Here's where it's broadened, Your Honor. If you had a system, let's take four again, just because that's been used, but that number, there's nothing magic about that number. If there were four indexes originally generated, and my accused software took those four indexes, and it generated four, it instantiated four, and it stored four, then I would infringe. But under the original claim language, if I generated four but instantiated one and second stored one, I would not infringe because I did not generate.
But the only change is to instantiate two. Isn't that a narrowing?
It's to double instantiate one. What it's saying is if, imagine four indexes being generated, but only one of them going through these series of steps that it calls out, meaning store, instantiate, and second store. In the instance where you had four generated by a program and less than all of them went through that process, you don't infringe. Now, after the amendment, you do, as long as you do that to one set of one index out of the four. That's why it's broadened. The reach has been expanded in a much more significant way than the reach was expanded in Quantum or Seattle Box. I have one other point that it wasn't highlighted in our brief that
because
I know.
Because you've exhausted your colleague's time.
Yeah, well, that's okay, I think.
Well, all right, another moment.
One last point, which is that in the record at 6... ...647, there is a document that was filed in this case by predicate with the trial court prior to the re-examination rejection occurring, prior to any of the issues occurring that we have right here. And in that document, if the court looks at it, it was a document that was a full claims description that was supposed to be put out by each side of their interpretation of the limitations of the claim. And
this is appendix page 647?
647, yeah, I believe so.
Is this discussed in your brief?
No.
And I don't have that in my appendix.
Okay. I believe it was filed, as I understood, but I'm not sure. At any rate, I won't go further if it's not. It was, as I understood, filed.
Well, all right. I think we have.
You have my understanding of it. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, and Mr. Kranke, we've exhausted your time fairly completely. Were you going to tell us something urgent?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you both.